Window seat or aisle? Can you sit in both at the same time? Alain Badiou, the post-Marxist continental philosopher, talks of the incommensurability of certain modes of thought, often citing the death of Archimedes as an example. The basic gist runs thus. The death of Archimedes, a short sketch. A Roman general, Marcellus, sends a soldier to fetch esteemed thinker Archimedes, but the Byzantine brainiac is working on a mathematical problem and ignores the soldier's summons. Not unpeeved, the squaddy restates his case, i.e., up you get. Archimedes, without looking up, says he'll come when he's solved the problem, thank you very much. The military man, exasperated and angry, kills Archimedes. Badiou terms this a philosophical situation. Archimedes' exercise in pure reason is not compatible with the civic demand made on him by the state. They have different temporality. The former conforms only to its own rhythm, the latter demands urgency. There is no crossover, and the only way to breach the gap between them is by the use of violence. This is why there are so many fistfights at the EasyJet customer service counter. How can Donna Jensen square her desire for Paris First Class International with her desire for home and hearth, as embodied in Ted Stewart, without doing violence to her heart? We all know the path to success requires that dead wood be burnt, and by dead wood, I mean living people. Only when you've established your dominion can you reward yourself with romance. You cannot dedicate yourself to self-advancement when you're in a relationship. How can you help yourself and another person at the same time? It's impossible. Here's a Times obituary you'll never read. As great a rock star as he was perhaps an even greater husband. No one who achieved anything was there for someone else. They were elsewhere, achieving. In this respect, romantic comedies have much less moral integrity than violent action films. The vigilante remains an outsider. He is not rewarded. He remains poor, unmoored, lonely. Contrast that with a couple whose highest priority is each other. How are they meant to stop the Kurdish terrorist from releasing the nerve gas? They'd be too busy staring into each other's eyes to notice. And if they did notice, how would they form a coherent plan under pressure, while respecting each other's equally valuable personhood? The only dilemma in the romantic comedy is, what keeps a couple apart? Once they're together, that's the end of anything interesting that could be said about them. It's a quick fade to black, and then on with their inward-facing existence. Two people whose highest priority is each other is not a monetizable prospect, nor does conscientious mutual consideration make for movie magic. In the romantic comedy, a man, let's call him Brad, neglects his family for his career, with the inevitable estrangement that follows, only to realize, late in the third act, that his family comes before everything. At this point, Brad will reject his work, refuse to give the big presentation to Yamamoto Corp, and run like hell to Bobby's piano recital. And when he arrives, he'll cheer louder than all the stiffs who wasted their time attending previous school events, because this school event is actually the important one and makes up for all the other historic absences. So who cares if his suit is sweat-sodden and he paid $20,000 for a seat on the last plane back from Denver? Because when Brad hugs his child, who played piano better than he ever thought possible because his awesome dad showed up for him, a seemingly innocuous remark from a bystander triggers one of Brad's madcap ideas. And they all run, as a family, into the patrician office of Brad's boss, disrupting its foie d'oeuvre. And Brad outlines an idea of such brilliance that the secretaries who've been there since Brad was a trainee stand up and start applauding. And Brad's boss gets a faraway look in his eye, like, this might work. Perhaps this is the very thing our business needs to survive in the modern competitive landscape. Even though his yuppie son Bobby says, Brad's crazy, Brad's always been crazy, it'll never work. Don't tell me you like this crazy idea. To which Brad's boss says, what do you know? You've had a silver spoon up your ass for so long it scooped out your brains. and Bobby looks shocked because an adult said something about a spoon going up someone's ass. But it's okay, it's just salty talk. In fact, it shows healthy nonconformity, and Brad's boss looks at young Bobby and says, "You know what, son? I had a crazy idea once. It was about setting up a company that takes risks, and that company put us on the map. Only now I think we've lost our way, and maybe that's because we've forgotten how to be crazy. And sure, maybe your dad is kind of crazy, but if Brad's crazy, so am I." We could all use a little crazy right now. And then Brad's boss looks up at Brad and asks, "Will you come back and maybe run the company for me? I think it's time I took the silver spoon out of my own ass and use it to make a little hay while the sun's still shining." And now Brad and his wife are hugging and bringing Bobby in close, so close. They've never been this close or rich. They're richer than ever, but truer too. And they'll never forget what's important. And although it may look like they're having their cake and eating it, for some reason, it's different from having your cake and eating it. It's more like working out how to manufacture cake on such a scale that you couldn't eat it all if you tried. But people who make films that tell us to prioritize family over work still expect us to pay to see their films. If I were to try to see one of their exhortations at the cinema, but found myself impecunious, could I, as a lover of romantic comedies, appeal to the good heart of the usher? Are you Ardy to the usher? Don't you see? I know I don't have any money to pay for a ticket. That's because I spend so much time playing with my children and being present to those I love. I've been fired from every job I ever had, but my school concert attendance record is second to none. They actually wondered whether I was a talent scout, but I said, no, I'm not a talent scout. I was a talent scout, but they kept wanting me to scout talent instead of impulsively fly kites with my children and giddily run through meadows and show up at my wife's work, she's a surgeon, and say, "Come with me now, I miss you. What's more important, this emergency appendectomy you're performing or taking time out for cupcakes and waffles?" I followed the name of Insert Name of Film for a long time. I managed to read the script of Insert Name of Film in advance. You see, I used to be an actor for a while. I was actually asked to read for a part in Insert Name of Film, but I'd promised my niece I'd play poo sticks with her whenever she wanted. And she said she wanted to play poo sticks at the same time as the audition, and she lived in Peckham, so it involved taking a train out to the country to find a stream that was magical enough. So I was, big deal, 3 or 4 days late for the audition. But those precious moments trudging through the pissing rain trying to find a stream that precisely conformed to a half-remembered line drawing of a stream from a book that I forgot to bring in the heady rush of it all? Well, those are moments you never get back. Anyway, I was so impressed with the script of Insert Name of Film and its message of family first that I thought I'd visit the set and tell the director how proud I was that he would devote so much of his time and effort to it, and that even though I wouldn't get to play a part in Insert Name of Film, because of my own family commitments, I was just so glad, as a cinema fan, that it was going to be made. So I went to the set, but I was told I couldn't see the director and that I had no right to be there. So I said, "Fine, I'll wait." And they said, "Well, we can't stop you." And I said, "That's right, you can't stop me." And then later I said, "Because you don't own the road, do you?" Which was both true and something I hadn't thought of straight away. In fact, there was a big enough gap between the two statements that I had to remind the guard what I was originally talking about. I waited until the director was finished for the day, which was very late, and I was sad because I actually missed dinner with my family. I was about to check into a travelodge when I saw the director leaving the studio, so I ran up to him and said, "I just want to say thank you for making this film about how important family is, because it's very important to me." And he said, "Who are you?" And I said, "A family man." And he said that being a family man was the best thing you could be, and that he had a family himself. "I expect you'll be going home to see them now," I said. He said that he wished he were, but they lived in America. He had 2 daughters. His wife had been accidentally decapitated at a theme park, but now they had a really good live-in au pair. I said, "Why don't they come over to be with you?" He said that he worked such long hours that he wouldn't get to see them anyway, and that even though it was hard for him to be away all this time because he's such a committed family man, they all decided it was best if they stayed in America with the au pair. He couldn't stress enough how good this au pair was, but he would get to see them in 5 weeks' time. I said, Why don't they come to the set? They could shout out ideas and create a nice atmosphere for everyone. He said, it's a nice thought, but I need to concentrate, and I don't know that I could do that with them around. I said, so you would rather they weren't here? There was a pause. He seemed tense for some reason, so I decided to ask another question to relax him. What scene were you shooting today? I asked. The scene where the hero's wife says that if he can't make it to their son's softball final, he needn't bother coming back. I like that scene, I said. So do I, he said. We both bowed our heads a little. Are you going to be here all night? Interrupted the guard. Some of us have got homes to go to. We're talking about the importance of family, asshole, I explained. The guard said something about not having seen his kids for 2 weeks now because he'd been working so late, and I said he should be grateful for the overtime and that there were plenty of people who would kill for his job. The guard said, don't you see the irony? I said that I didn't, and that if there were any irony about the place, I would have seen it, because I'm an artist, and that's what I'm trained to do. I said that the director and I were creative people, and that we had a different ontology to him. Our needs are non-commensurate with yours, Marcellus, I added. Don't prove quote Alan Badu to me, said the guard. I haven't got the time. We looked at each other. We saw one another. We finally understood one another. We all laughed and held each other close. I'd never felt as close to anyone as to those two men, all three of us desperate to get back to our families, but instead deciding to go out for ribs and talk about the breakthrough we'd made and also to drink beer. Somehow we all lost our phones so we couldn't get Ubers, and I decided to walk because it wasn't that far, but I realised it was at least 50 miles till I would be outside my front door. And then I thought, I wish we could get an au pair. I'm a hostage in my own home. The usher looked at me. I could tell my story had moved her. She now knew there was more to this world than the mere material, that something as tawdry and gross as money would be a Badu-like barrier to our two souls touching in a subconscious fist bump of empathy and understanding. But by that time, the film was nearly over. I think that's why she told me to leave.